Beyond UWA features inspiring graduates and friends from around the world. In their own words, we hear how UWA alumni from all walks of life are making an impact in the world as they share what they've learned along the way. I'm Kieran Hargraves, Director of Alumni and Community Engagement at UWA, and I hope you enjoy our latest episode.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to this webinar, conversation, chat, whatever you want to call it. And we are here today with some fantastic guests. So, yeah, I didn't give any of the guests kind of warnings where we were actually going in this conversation. So I'm going to quickly introduce you all, and I'm going to ask you a question to kind of expand on that. And so right now we're going to start with Michael Sheldrick. Michael, and I have this written all out here because I'm trying to be prepared as possible here, is the co-founder of Global Citizen. And he is, look, I have two sets of glasses. This is how old I am now. I've got to have two sets of glasses, one for reading far and one for near. He is the co-founder and chief policy impact and government affairs officer, or as I like to say, he's the CPIGAO. Global Citizenship, and it's an amazing organization. I'll let him explain what they do. Thank you, Michael, for being here. Next, I want to quickly introduce Dr. Gracie Verde Silva. Did I get that right, Gracie?
In Portuguese, we say Verde Silva, but you got it close in a Spanish language.
So phonetically, I was somewhat correct. Let's just go with that. And that's not my strong suit. So Gracie is the Executive Sustainability Manager at Minerva Foods, which she has a really interesting job. I can't wait for her to share with you all what she does. And finally, we have August, Wylinko. Nod your head. Yes. Awesome. Great. August, to me, is such a critical piece of the sustainability conversation because she's at an organization called Life Cycles, and she's the Harvest and Volunteer Coordinator. And I can't wait for her to tell me that. But before we start, I want to level set this conversation about what is sustainability. There's a big conversation around sustainability and what it means for different people. And so I did some due diligence here, and I want you guys to tell me if I'm on the right track for a definition of sustainability. So sustainability is the concept and practice that involves meeting the needs of the present without compromising the ability of the future generations to meet their own needs. Would we agree with that? Yes, no, Michael, what do you think?
I've always been told about this concept of stewardship, right? And we shouldn't keep the planet. Planet's not a museum. We're not curators. You know, resources are there for us to use, but at the same time, they're not there for us to plunder for the sake of the and prevent the future generation, future animals, future species from also enjoying that. So the idea of stewardship, how can we take, but also give of what we take, right? So I think, you know, that's at its heart what the concept of net zero is about when we talk about climate change. So, you know, I liked what you said, and it seems to correlate closely with that concept of good stewardship. Yeah.
So for Gracie, if you take that, would you layer on top of that the notion of environmental sustainability, social sustainability, and economic sustainability?
Yeah, you've gone straight to the heart of the definitions that have been debated in many of the international forums over the last few decades. But I think that sustainability is a term which is very broadly used. It's used to describe a lot of different things, which may or may not be sustainable, depending on everybody's different understandings of what that word means. But I think that the core message that that we have to find a way to inhabit this planet in a way that we don't jeopardize the ability of our great-grandchildren to also inhabit this planet, and not just inhabit but to live, to enjoy, to thrive on this planet is definitely fundamental. The three pillars, the social, environmental, and the governance aspect as well, the economic aspect, are totally fundamental to this, because you really can't have an environmental solution if you're not considering many of the people who are involved in the impacts. And that's exactly what my PhD thesis actually looked at, the impact of environmental public policy on traditional communities inhabiting protected areas. So yes, you definitely need to look at the whole picture, and these questions are always very complex, but complex problems do not have simple solutions. So we need complex solutions as well.
And so just to add one more layer to this, to bring Gracie's voice, to bring August's voice into the conversation, at the community level, does that definition sit with you in the right way? That definition of taking care of today for the future? And I'm paraphrasing there.
Definitely. I see sustainability as a crossover of environmentalism and social justice, especially in the work that I do. Mm-hmm. And I think that idea that we're looking after our people today for them to be able to look after the future, and our land today for it to be able to sustain itself and the people of the future.
So yeah. I can agree that we all agree on this basic definition.
I think so. And I just something there that you were touching on as well is currently today, right? Looking after folks today, but preserving what we have for future generations. But I would also say there is a dimension of equity there about making sure that sustainable action today doesn't also come at the expense of people today. And what I mean by that is I deal with a lot of countries, a lot of leaders in the global south, and for them, they always hate it when sustainability and equity don't go hand in hand, because to them, it can come across that you're asking them to make trade-offs around their own livelihoods and economic aspirations in the name of, say, fighting climate change, et cetera. So I think there is that equity direct dimension to it in terms of also what does sustainability, sustainable action look like today as well. Yeah.
So now that we've level set, and thank you for that, now we can actually introduce the audience to who you guys are. So I'm going to start with you, August. Can you briefly introduce yourself to what your UWA degree was and really what you're currently doing? Now, because I am so strict with time, you've got 2 minutes to nail this down, August, and then we're going to move on. Please introduce yourself. I can't wait for everyone to hear and learn more about you.
Hi, I graduated actually last year with a Bachelor of Politics, Philosophy, and Economics, and I also minored in climate change. And then I moved basically straight to Canada. So I've been here for almost a year and a half. And I've been working in food security almost the whole time. I've been with Life Cycles for a while. And we work in food security in promoting connection to land and the food that you eat, and also helping the local Victoria population, because we are quite isolated here and there's also a high percentage of homelessness, and also BC has the highest Indigenous population. So there's a combination of different issues as well as inflation, cost of living, and everything else. So Life Cycles is here to try and be a movement that combats all these different issues and help people learn more about how to grow their own produce as well as accessing healthy produce. And I'm really passionate about it, as food security to me is kind of the connection between, like I said, environmentalism and social justice and equitable food systems. And it uses both, I guess, my economics knowledge and also my interest in environmentalism and climate change.
We're going to come back to that because you play such a critical part in this whole puzzle. We're next, I'm going to have Gracie, Dr. Gracie, quickly introduce herself to the audience. And again, just remind the question, what degree did you get? And then what's your current position and role? Where are you located? That's another important thing in this conversation.
So I have an undergraduate degree in environmental science with honors in environmental education. And then I got the PhD with UWA in 2018, which was looking at environmental governance and public policy. I'm located close to São Paulo in Brazil. So I'm just about an hour inland from São Paulo city. And I currently work for Minerva Foods, which is the largest beef exporter from South America. So we have operations in 5 countries: Uruguay, Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, and Colombia. And in my role, I am responsible for implementing projects which create value propositions for ranchers to implement regenerative and low carbon emission practices on their farms. So we implement a number of different projects. We provide technical assistance, green finance, access to the voluntary carbon market, a lot of different kinds of incentives to support this sustainable transformation of the livestock sector into a highly efficient and highly sustainable food production system.
That's awesome. Michael, last but most famously least, or is that the wrong way to say that? You're up next, please.
Well, thanks. So my name's Michael and I studied law and arts at UWA, graduated in 2012. And whilst at university in the anthropology common room, which I'm not sure if it still exists, hopefully it does, in the social science block, a group of us activists got together, those at UWA together with other student activists across the country, and we founded this organization called Global Citizen. And Global Citizen today is a movement of millions of citizens around the world taking action to end extreme poverty. We're most known for our POP and policy approach. So through some of our big events where people take action, they earn tickets to see some of the biggest artists in the world. But we also do a lot in policy advocacy, working with the media around the world, working with many partners. And so it's been over 10 years now, and it's brought me all around the world, including where I'm sitting now, which is where I live, which is here in Brooklyn, New York.
Brooklyn. I love Brooklyn. Well, thank you guys again. And, you know, from my perspective, this is such a great, diverse set of panelists today, because you're all working on sustainability from different angles. And with that, you know, we have about 40 minutes to dive into some really great questions. So I'm going to start with you, Michael. So as co-founder of Global Citizen, where does your passion for this social change originate from? Like, where does this isn't an easy task that you're that you're on right now, this journey?
Yeah, look, long story short, I think it comes from, you know, an appreciation of the opportunities I had and really the gratitude for those opportunities growing up in Perth. You know, when I was at school, I still remember first year of school being ranked bottom in the class, being told I wouldn't amount to anything. And I remember this teacher pulling me aside and saying, look, I think there's more to you than meets the eye. And he really pushed me and he spent time with me, you know, after school, extra hours. And quite quickly, I went from the bottom kid in the class to the top kid in the class, was able to get great education, get into university, UWA. But I never lost that moment of that teacher pulling me aside. And I always felt, my goodness, what would happen if I never had that teacher? And as I, you know, went to university, learned more about these issues, you know, and understood that there were so many millions of children around the world who, through no fault of their own, maybe it's because they don't have a great teacher, maybe it's because they don't have a great education system, maybe it's because they die before the age of five because of vaccine-preventable diseases, but they would never be able to earn their potential. So I guess for me, my passion comes from the gratitude and the awareness that we had it pretty good where we grew up, and there was something that I could do that I could contribute. I thought that would be to become a lawyer, but I ended up being an advocate of a different sort. And I quickly learned that policy changes systems, systems change lives. And so I focused a big chunk of my time on trying to bring about systemic policy change.
Now, one of your bigger missions is really to end poverty, right? Global poverty. And it's a big, lofty. Now, according to my research today, you know, as of 2021, about 9.2% of the world lives in poverty, give or take, you know.
Yeah.
How do you, and by the way, Gracie or August, please add value to any of these questions at any time. So, you know, please add to Michael. But how do you as an organization know you're achieving that goal, that mission? I mean, that's important to you, right? Like this is your mission. How does that keep you fired knowing that it feels like it's almost unattainable?
Well, I think the important thing to recognize is that until relatively recently, and it was really the pandemic, you know, we were making incredible progress when it came to ending extreme poverty. In my lifetime alone, you know, we had seen the number of people living in extreme poverty more than halved. And just before the pandemic, there was a study that came out and it showed that if we could provide an extra $350 billion a year, which sounds like a lot of money, but to put it in perspective, that is half of what the US spends on military every year. So let's put it in perspective. In the grand scheme of budgets, it's not that much. you know, that would be enough to end extreme poverty. And of course, COVID set in, you know, there's a huge debt crisis right now that prevent governments from spending, you know, on the health and education of their citizens. But we can all, we also know that it is possible because we saw that progress. And frankly, we've seen it in other areas as well. We've seen that when we invest in solidarity, it pays off. And one of our longest standing campaigns, James, has been around the eradication of polio. And when I got involved in that, there were 1,000 cases still prevalent, 4 countries that were endemic. Today, that's down to 2 countries and less than a handful. I think it's like less than 10 cases this year. And we're on the brink of making that disease just the second human disease in history. And that's been through cooperation, and it's been through investments, and it's been through citizens raising their voices.
That's amazing. And I feel like that's a whole other topic we could go down, you know, with the partnerships you've had. Now, Gracie, for you, you're in a different realm of sustainability. So I'm really interested why what you do is passionate for you. And, you know, because it's really important. You're ground zero for the rainforest and managing that process. So I'd love to kind of hear, you know, your passion for food sustainability.
I think the agricultural sector has so much potential to contribute to so many, to being part of the solution of so many of the problems that we face. So here, talking about Brazil, for example, a huge number of people are engaged in smallholder farming activities, and about 70% of the food that is eaten domestically is produced by family farmers. So they're a really significant factor in food security in Brazil, and we need to have public policies which supports them to be able to stay on their land and have economically viable and sustainable productive systems. But that's only one aspect of it. I think that when we talk about the vast potential that is Brazil and South America in terms of food production, so Brazil is one of the largest exporters of food of any country in the whole world, and it does that within a tropical climate with so many advantages in terms of having really highly efficient and productive systems and abundant natural resources which promote that. So we don't have irrigation. We don't need irrigation. We have rainfall, which supports all of the crops. So we can do things naturally in a much lower impact way. And when you do help this sector transform into being a lower impact sector, you can create so many co-benefits. So when you take a degraded area of pasture and you help a farmer to recover that area and put more heads of cattle on that, you're actually sucking carbon out of the atmosphere and storing it into the soil and the biomass. So you're contributing towards solving climate change. When you have a farmer who has a legal reserve, so here in Brazil, all of the landowners are required to maintain native vegetation on their properties. In the Amazon biome, that's 80% of their property that must maintain as forest, and in other biomes, it ranges from 20 to 35%. But when you work with farmers to plan out where those legal reserves are going to be, you can actually create biological corridors. So you can create connectivity throughout the landscape between areas which are under conservation through protected areas and public policy.
Why is this passionate for you? I'm curious, like, why this is passionate for you? Because, I mean, there's a whole lot, like Michael and like, we could have a whole other podcast or a conversation around just Brazil and the rainforest. What I'm curious is, this is a high passion field, sustainability. And I'm just curious why this matters so much to you.
I think part of it is that agriculture is always seen as the villain, particularly here in Brazil. And it's a really just putting everything in the same basket, right? Most of the West and the European countries that actually don't know what happens here on the ground, they don't have any contact, and brush everything with the same color. And obviously we have really big challenges in terms of deforestation and other challenges here, but there's so much potential and so much good work that's already being done in the country. And I really think that we need to get that message out there as well, because that's what you can do to attract investment and finance and all the things that we need to make this happen at an even larger scale than it is today. So I think it's partly to do with that, standing up for the underdog and helping something that has so much potential become actually real, you know?
Yeah. Because, I mean, there's so many misperceptions or conceptions of what goes on down there. I mean, as the layperson, all I hear is deforestation, deforestation, deforestation. And, you know, you talk about things like, you know, pasture management, you know, as a process of helping, you know, the environment in a different way. I want to go one step closer, and this is really to August. You know, August, you know, it appears for me, at least in my tertiary knowledge, that life cycles is really ground zero for sustainability, because you're trying to change human behavior at the end of the day. And so you're supporting the Victoria community with sustainable practices. Can you share your passion? And I'm just curious from your passion for your desire to change the community-based approach versus, you know, what Gracie's doing is amazing at the organizational sustainability approach, and what Michael's doing is at the global policy approach. You know, so as a triangle, to me, you're kind of on the ground. So what is your passion for being on the ground trying to engage in this behavior change?
Yeah, I think I've always kind of had the saying in the back of my mind that global problems require local solutions. I don't know where I learned that, but
I like it
a lot, especially in this type of work. I mean, both of what you two are doing is incredible and very inspiring and interesting work. I love being around people and working with people and seeing the impact that selfishly, I guess, I make on other people's lives, and you get to be right there with them, which is one of the benefits of community work, and also working with other people and hearing stories from your community and getting to learn about the lives of people that you live with is also really a lovely thing to be a part of. I think an organization like Life Cycles aligns with that kind of idea that real change starts at a grassroots level. I don't mean that change doesn't start on other levels. It's just that I see it as a lot of the time there's policies and there's organizations that kind of create the system, but the grassroots organizations are the ones that do the work, or the small companies are the ones that do the work on the ground. So it requires everyone to kind of be a part of this process. And I really like doing the more hands-on aspect to it. Yeah. I also ran some initiatives at UWA that was that kind of concept of hands-on work. I do think that big businesses and governments ultimately have to address the climate crisis and help create sustainable cities. But yeah, grassroots organizations and communities are here to support and implement those changes.
So I think what's really interesting, I'm going to bring Michael's voice in this in a second, because, you know, in our pre-call, Michael, you brought up a really good point about August's role in the whole thing. But this is a really interesting story for me is, you know, my mom is Canadian by nature. She was born in Toronto, but moved to Canada. Moved to the States. You know, she was 18, 19. I would go visit my grandma in Toronto, and she would practice sustainable habits around food waste and recycling and whatever. And my mom did not. And it was the complete opposite. And I thought what was really interesting is the cultural overlay of teaching those behaviors to your citizens of what's most important in society. And so, you know, Michael, I'd love to kind of bring your voice into this notion, because, you know, when we were having the pre-call, you really gave August some really good kudos about what she's doing in conjunction to what you guys do.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that people at the community level are some of the best advocates, and policy change, you know, is often about people at the end of the day. People change people, including policymakers. And often when you speak with political leaders or those in business and you ask them, you know, what got you to change, it's often the exposure, it's the relationships that they've built with people, but importantly, it's those people's stories. And I think one of my favorite authors is Catherine Hayhoe, who wrote a book on how to talk about climate change. And she says one of the most powerful things we can do is if we are making change, we're changing our behavior, but it's to tell that story to someone else. Because when we tell that story to someone else, that could inspire them as well, including policymakers. And she tells this one story of this guy who, from listening to her, went off and had basically tracked 12,000 conversations that began with this one. And it resulted in policy change, including like local councillors of a particular local shire, I think it was in England, divesting from fossil fuels. So I think, you know, at Global Citizen, we talk about people, and we often will begin with what can you do in your own behavior? Because if you can change that, that gives you credibility to speak about these issues and then connect that to policy change. So I love these initiatives. I think sometimes one of my regrets is I don't have enough time to do more of that myself. But I've met some inspiring people out there, and I think that's what keeps me going in the work we're doing when we're having these tough conversations.
Gracie, it got me thinking a little bit about your work in Brazil. How do the locals take to these sustainable practices? Is it challenging to get them to change habits? Are they on board because they know it's so important?
The thing is that sustainable practices are more efficient and more productive, so they make more money. Yeah. From the same amount. You take a degraded pasture and you recover it, you can put three or four cows there instead of one, and you can sell three or four cows instead of one. So the argument, it's so simple. And these practices are well
that's
known.
That's the economic sustainability model, right? The triple bottom line, that's the economic argument.
Exactly. Environment and sustainability, it's just a co-benefit for them. Yeah. And there's enough science, there's really good knowledge about best practices, about integrated crop livestock forest practices, about how to implement them with different species in different regions. But what's missing sometimes is the investment, so access to financial resources to make the transformation, and also knowledge sometimes, so that the capacity to know how to undertake those changes. So that's where we come in and try and support with those aspects.
Well, that kind of leads to that my next question for you, Gracie. You know, in your current role, you're the link between the company and the rural producers, right? So how do you then balance profitability with social and environmental sustainability? Now, I'm going to guess you've already given us the answer to this already in terms of it just makes sense, but I feel like there's still challenges for adoption and all that. And you just kind of talked about the financial adoption, but is there anything we're missing in trying to make that connection from what you do to the local person, to the mass organization like Minerva, which, you know, I did some research. I think they had $4.5 billion in USD revenue last year. So they're no small animal. I meant that metaphor, small animal. They're no small organization in this world of what they do.
Yeah. That's one of the things I like about my job is the potential for huge impact once we reach scale. For Minerva, it's also a strategic decision because we see now with the EU regulations where they're going to close out any imports where you can't prove that there has been zero deforestation connected to it. Other markets are very interested in traceability and carbon footprint aspects of products. So if you want to be in the game for the long term, which Minerva obviously does, you've got to get in the game from now, right? You've got to start building capacity within the company to be able to attend all of these future and current demands from the market. So it's actually a very simple argument in all aspects of the company, because the economic sustainability depends on the environmental sustainability of the company as well.
So I'm curious on that note, in terms of proving the sustainability of your product. You know, there's some research I read and some articles I read about the notion of using blockchain to track that process and make it immutable. Is this something that Minerva is looking at as a way to create a verified tracking of the whole sustainable process?
Yeah, there are a lot of interesting technological supports for sustainability projects, and blockchain definitely can play a role in guaranteeing that what's happening in one area can be tracked throughout its entire life cycle. But not just that, there's a bunch of other things available nowadays, and I don't think we probably have time to get into them.
Yeah.
Yes, technology will play a role, definitely.
That was my curiosity coming. I'm sure, Michael, you're seeing this more and more globally as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think just to piggyback off what Gracie was saying, you know, what we're really seeing in a lot of those developments, it's come in, and whether it's regulatory, technological developments, but it's also about how can you make sure that the proceeds, right, actually benefit those communities who are doing the work. I mean, we throw around concepts like voluntary carbon markets, et cetera, but when you look at an issue like deforestation, you know, Indigenous people represent 5% of the world's population, and yet apparently, like, you know, you look at the stats, when you look at rates of deforestation, you know, if it's managed by Indigenous communities, they're far more effective at addressing the problem. And often they don't see the benefits from that. And so, you know, one thing we got involved in a few years ago, we work with Coldplay, who, I mean, Coldplay are big anywhere, but in Brazil, it turns out they're next level big. And some of these Indigenous groups, we weren't getting a meeting with the president, that was Bolsonaro. They said, could you help us get the attention of our governors? And so, you know, he retweeted their letter to the governors and say, why don't you meet with these groups? And six of them actually replied and did. And one of them created an area that was, I think, the equivalent of the state of Vermont, in terms of the protected area, one of the largest protected areas declared, you know, throughout the Bolsonaro years. But I think what we're really seeing, like in Australia and other places, is that agency and that desire to say, look, we're part of the solution, but we need to benefit from this as well. And so that's been a big driver of our work increasingly in the last year or so, I would say.
That's amazing. Hey, August, I want to kind of dovetail what I was talking about with Grace here on the economics. And, you know, how does life cycles, I remember there's an S there, position the economic benefit of the local sustainability practice, right? Like, why would I, as a community member who has an apple tree in the backyard, want you to be part of this? How does that help me?
Yeah, I think COVID especially really highlighted to a lot of people the importance of local produce, food security, and how expensive food costs can be and now have become. Don't know specifically about Australia, but I know that inflation in Canada is extremely high. So people are stressed and worried about food security here. And I guess for the people, yeah, on the other side receiving the support, there isn't much of, I guess, an economic argument. You get local produce for free. So that's great, and it's creating jobs as well.
It also feels like what you're doing also, though, August, is, you know, we talk about poverty. It's helping, you know, one of the biggest issues of poverty is really food security, mm-hmm. right? And it feels like you're filling that void at the community level. And if people aren't feeling hungry, they are more engaged in their life. They're more engaged in the mm-hmm. moment. But that moment-to-moment having to find food, having to eat, whether you're a child in school, whether you're an adult working, it's a problem. And it feels like what Life Cycles is doing is meeting that gap by those practices. Would that, am I leaning too heavy into that, or does that feel about right?
I think food is very important. Obviously, there's a lot of overlaying issues that lead to homelessness and poverty and these bigger issues. And food is definitely a part of it and a very important factor in getting someone to engage in their life. And I guess, are you asking how it relates back to the economics part?
I guess what I'm curious about, and sorry, I wasn't very clear, is where I see Life Cycles filling a huge void is that food insecurity phase. So people in poverty who are struggling to make ends meet can get this free mm-hmm. organic local food to fill that void of what they can't necessarily mm-hmm. Afford to fill up the cupboards, if you will. Is that correct? Yeah.
Yeah, I think
there was no question there, August. That was just a statement. So you can just affirm it or deny it.
Yes.
Perfect. All right. Awesome. So then I kind of want to move on. Then I kind of have a follow on question with that or for you, August. So here you are in Victoria, Canada, beautiful island. It is gorgeous. If you've never been there, go there. And you're supporting Life Cycles at the community level. Now, is it hard to get community buy-in at large-scale sustainability projects? Like, do you guys find it hard to get the community to buy in on that? And then what success are you seeing that could be replicated in other communities? Are there things you're doing well? Do you think could be placed someplace else? and be replicated again. And just to give you an example, I kind of did some quick research, and there are similar programs called City Fruit in Seattle, Growing Power in Milwaukee, the Green Belt Foundation in Ontario. There are a number of communities that are trying to do the same thing. What do you think that Life Cycles is doing well that maybe other communities could pick up?
Yeah, I think we're a lucky organization in that we have hundreds of volunteers who support us. And again, like many, many food banks that also work with us. And I think this is partly because we've been around for about almost 30 years. And so there's the reputation and there's the support there. I also think because we are able to attract people, because you get produce, whether you're helping at a farm, helping in someone's backyard, an orchard, at the food bank, you're able to access the food and anyone's able to be a part of it, whether or not you're low income. And so that really draws people in. Also creating the community, you're meeting other people who are in similar position to you or also care about sustainability and food security. And so all these factors bring a lot of people together to volunteer for Life Cycles, which is amazing. I know I've worked for, volunteered for other organizations where it's really hard to get volunteers and community support. So I guess I'm trying to say this organization is maybe kind of not, I don't have a lot of advice because it is so easy in a way to get people to engage, because it is so fundamental to people's life and well-being to have good food, and especially fruit and vegetables. I think there are other things that other organizations that are similar can adopt. We also have really good software to help coordinate all of the different harvesting, because there's about five different programs that go on and, like I said, hundreds of volunteers. So having good management and organization is definitely a big part of it. And also having a lot of connections with other organizations, that whether that's on either end, the farms or the food banks, or it's similar sustainable related organizations that might be able to use your technology or use your volunteers or however it happens. So,
you know what I'm hearing when you describe that? And Grace, I'd love to know if you feel the same way and you're seeing the same thing in Brazil at the more micro level, is the role culture plays in creating. I kind of go back to my example of my grandma was fully into it and my mom was not. And in the US, I feel like we're lagging a little bit behind at the national level around getting communities to practice sustainable practices. And I might be projecting that, but it would seem like that's the case. I don't know if Michael, you're seeing that nationally. It's just really tough to get US citizens really upticket, if you will. Gracie, do you see in Brazil a culture shift around embracing sustainable practices at the community level? And versus, I know the previous government didn't really have sustainability practices in their mind, but I'm just curious where you kind of see that in the culture. Completely not on these questions whatsoever, by the way. So this is a complete right turn.
No, it's fine. Brazil still faces really huge challenges in terms of overcoming basic daily survival challenges. So we, unfortunately, during the last government and the pandemic, saw millions of people slide back into poverty. And the vast majority of the population doesn't have time to think about community sustainability actions. They're thinking about going to work and being able to pay the bills that month. So Brazil has a long way to go to be able to get there. But I think with this government that we have now, we have a much clearer pathway. We have very clear signals in terms of public policy and enforcement actions in terms of the public policy, which really need to happen. So I think once we can get the country back onto an economic, a better economic position, we will open up space to be able to discuss those things here as well. But the one thing has to happen before the other can.
Yeah. So Michael, this is kind of another out of the left view curiosity question. You know, you are at the global level. You're kind of looking at sustainability at the global level, you know, whether it's poverty, whether it's food, whether it's economic, whatever. What country do you think is doing a great job at this right now? What are you guys seeing out there as a country that really has nailed sustainability, or at least moving in that direction?
Well, I think Brazil is a fascinating story, and I had the opportunity to be in the Amazon. President Lula hosted this Amazon summit with all the leaders from the Amazon back in August, and you know, two things that really stood out to me was, one, his focus on inclusion, what I was saying about putting indigenous people front and center, because yes, it's global policy, but it's to benefit people at the end of the day. But also some of his policies were working. I mean, you look at deforestation in the Amazon, and over the last year, and you mentioned some of the enforcements, Gracie, that they've led on, but in the last year, my understanding is deforestation has reduced by 66% from what it was. So, you know, and they're going to be hosting the G20, they've got the COP, you know, so I think people are excited about that. Of course, people will also point out, well, what about fossil fuel extraction in the Amazon? You know, every country has its spectrum. You know, there's two leaders that I also really admire and, you know, have had the opportunity to meet and see and be inspired by, and that is Mia Motley, the Prime Minister of Barbados, who I encourage anyone to check out her speeches. She's phenomenal. She's a real force. And really what she makes the case around is climate change and financial equity can't be divorced. And if countries don't have the means to be able to withstand natural disasters, to be able to bounce back, they're just going to get into a ton of debt, this vicious cycle that's going to make them more vulnerable. They're not going to be able to adapt. And then the other—
especially in the island countries, by the way. The island countries just get hammered all the time.
Exactly. Yeah. One comes around, a storm misses, but, you know, another one's coming. And then the other one is Kenya. I mean, I didn't appreciate this, but Kenya, I didn't know, is 92% powered by renewables. And their president, who was elected about a year ago, William Ruto, is saying, yes, we need the West to deliver on their promises, but we can't sit around and wait. And actually, if we leapfrog this thing, we might actually be able to generate jobs for our young people. And I love that these people actually saying it doesn't have to be a trade-off. We can meet the aspirations of young people and transition to a clean energy future and talking about jobs. So, yeah, and there's others, you know, at the local level, I see at the state level, you know, at the provincial level, you know, really, really all examples of advocacy going on.
Can I just say that those were neither two examples I thought you were going to go with? Like, I was thinking Western Europe someplace, you know, someplace that in my mind would make a lot of sense. So those are two places I would never have predicted that you would have gone. One of the things I always find curious, you know, when people talk about, I'm going to use climate change as kind of the example, and I'm going to use very left versus right mentality. And this isn't meant to be a political conversation, but like when one side says, well, it's fake, right? It's not real. Climate change isn't real. I often say, well, whether it is or isn't, doesn't really matter. Is it worth risking if it is real, right? Like maybe we don't know, but what if we're wrong? And is it worth that, being wrong about that, more than it is being right about it not being a big deal? I don't know if that made sense or not, but in my head, I'm like, we have these arguments all the time. Is it real, not real? And I think we don't really, we know, but like those that say we don't know, what if they're wrong? Like, can't that be the framing of the conversation? Is, yeah, maybe it's not, but do we want to hedge? Like, to me, it seems like a huge gamble in this whole entire thing. You know, this conversation of sustainability, as we're coming to a close here in the next few minutes, we'll kind of open up the room for questions if there are any questions. You know, I want to kind of have two final questions, and if these can be quick, short ones, it'd be great. And I'll start with you, August. I would love to hear your greatest hope for the future when it comes to sustainability. And I know that's a big question, but you're a big brain, God. And I know you know the answer to this in a very succinct way. You're smarter than I am by far.
I hope for the future, I guess, within the world of food security or just in general.
You can choose. It's your context. You can go wherever you want to go.
I guess I just hope to see a world in which people are able to live how they want to live while preserving for future generations in whatever means. Like, some people like to live on the land, some people love technology, like being able to provide all of that through agriculture, transitioning from fossil fuels, the whole thing.
That's awesome. I know it's a very big question. And I realized when I asked it, when you were like, where do you want me to go? So I'm going to narrow it down for Gracie, by the way. So Gracie, what is your hope for the sustainability and practices around the Amazon and the rainforest? If you were to forecast to 2030.
For the general question.
You can go that way if you want to go that way.
I just really hope that we make it. I hope that we manage to rally as a species. Mm. We have so little time now. We're really getting to the tipping points. And once we get to those tipping points, we just don't know what's going to happen. The modeling that's been done by the best climate scientists around the world didn't predict what's happening today. Mm. So I just really hope that we manage to do it. I have kids, so I think about that.
Gracie, I was hoping for a little bit more uplifting hope.
No, I'm sorry. That's where I'm at today.
Michael, how about you? What you do in your world, what's a hope that you have for the future?
Yeah, I mean two things. I mean, I think firstly, I'm gonna shamelessly plug this report we just released called the Global Solidarity Report.
Awesome.
We've been working on global citizenship for a while, but we've actually never measured the yardstick of how we're going. And on the one hand, it does show we're in the danger zone, as Gracie say, you know, institutions are not doing, the impacts are off. But it also shows, when you look at people and their identities, you know, a profound number of people, whether it's in the US, China, or around, you know, still believe in, they possess to believe in being a global citizen more than often citizens of their own country. And they also candidly believe in collective action and working together, which shows that actually many of our citizens are ahead of where our leaders are as well. And I think the second thing I would say is I was listening to this podcast recently on climate change, and it was a similar dismal situation. And someone said to this guy, you know, what do you say to your kids? Like, what are we going to grow up, and what have you left us for, and how can we make an impact? And he just made the point. He said, look, you can look at it in two ways that we're doing, but you can also look at it in this sense. And that is, you know, as an accident of our birth and us being born here and now at this moment in time, you know, the actions we take today will have profoundly more consequence than potentially, you know, any action taken by a previous generation in the history of humanity. And our ability, you know, because of that, will have an outsized impact on those who live 5 years from now, 15 years from now, or 50 years from now. Like, it's a, there's never been a bigger moment to have a bigger impact on the world than people right now. And that's daunting. It comes with a lot of responsibility, but also it's a reminder that we still have a lot to fight for, and we can make a difference and shape the world as well.
That's awesome. I have one final question for all of you. You know, we're gathered here today due to our shared connection to UWA. So I didn't say to the audience, I got my PhD there. You know, my background is in marketing, consumer psychology. So I look at sustainability from a little bit different lens, from how do you get people to buy, consume, and use sustainability practices. But each of you pursued your passion, even across the globe. We got Brazil, New York, you know, Victoria. If you could give one piece of advice to inspire our audience to turn their passions into a career, what would it be? And I'm going to start with Michael this way, and we'll work our way around.
One piece of advice to turn our passions into a career, is that right?
Which can always be a debate, by the way, follow your passion or not. But like, in this particular context, if you're passionate about sustainability, what bit of advice would you give them to follow your career? Well, I'll leave it to that. I'll let you kind of decide how you want to do it.
It's a good point. Look, I always tell people, I always struggle with this because I never went out to set a career. I just started volunteering and I created something. So I always say, like, don't necessarily look at this as a career or an occupation. Look at it as a vocation. How do you want to live your life? And then just start doing that. And it may end up being something where you can create a career out of it. It may not. But that's where I'd start. You know, my sister just moved back to WA from England. She works at the Conservation Council of WA. She started volunteering in bats, right? Saving bats in the UK. And now she's back leading the citizen engagement project because of that work at the Conservation Council. And she was working in finance.
That's awesome. Gracie, how about you? What would be a bit of advice for someone to follow the sustainability track? What would get them excited about doing it?
I think the people who are excited about doing it are already excited about doing it because there's so many people engaged with this topic now. It's such a normal thing, I think, for the upcoming generations and the youth. It's so present, you know, in the day-to-day life. So I think it's and I think it's very interesting because the options for working in this area have just multiplied so much in recent years. Yeah. My job wouldn't have existed maybe 3, 4, 5 years ago, the one I'm doing today. Yeah. But I also never planned a career in this. I also was more in the academic area, researching and things, and just opportunities came along and I just took them up and here I am today. So I think if you're really passionate about it and getting involved in whichever way you can, be through volunteer work or studying about it, learning about it, engaging in community groups and these kinds of things, pathways will come along and amazing things can be done.
That's awesome. August, I'm going to slightly switch the question for you. Why should someone who's listening want to be engaged at the community level for sustainability practices?
I was kind of going to say the same things that Gracie said anyway. So why would someone want to be engaged in community?
Yeah, why would I want to go get a part of my community today to have an impact on the future around sustainability?
I think part of like what she said and what I was going to say was being around people who are similar to you and motivate and inspire you. And I think when you go into the community and volunteer or work, then you're going to be around those people because they're the ones that are taking time out of their day to volunteer in an organization that's doing sustainable work. So by being surrounded by people who are just as passionate as you, you're going to be further motivated to do work in this area. And that is one of the benefits of community-based work.
That's awesome. I just want to dovetail quickly. Thank you for that. On something Gracie said, which is so true. I just spent up until 2020 living in the Middle East, just outside Dubai. The amount of sustainability projects they have going on between Saudi Arabia and the UAE is unbelievable. And there's probably never been a better time to enter that space, whether it's from renewable energy to crop in the middle of the desert, creating crops out of nothing in the desert. It's unbelievable. Like these huge football fields they create, they all need experts and people and individuals who are passionate about that to help solve massive problems. With that, I want to say thank you. I want to say thank you to Gracie, to August, to Michael for taking your time. Thank you to UWA for allowing us to have this event today. You know, this is a really important conversation that needs to keep going. You know, I have 4 kids, you know, and so to Gracie's point, they may not have a future if we don't start acting today. You know, we live in Bend, which is 3 hours from the ocean. The ocean may be in Bend in 20 years. I don't know, you know, so this topic is so relevant and the work that UWA is doing, that their alumni is doing in this around this area is so relevant, so important. So thank you to you all for taking time and engaging in my questions.
Thanks so much, James, and to all of you. I mean, there's been some amazing insights and sharing today. And I think there's also been some real inspiration as well that, you know, this is a huge topic and thing that we're all grappling with, but there's some amazing work and inroads that have been happening in the sustainability space as well. So thank you all so much for your time. Thank you to the audience for joining us today, those who are with us now and those who will be watching this back later. Don't forget to update your details. Let us know where you are in the world so we can make sure you're invited to events like this in the future. And thanks very much again.